Green Gold, the Empire of Tea. In a few months, the book which I wrote with my mother, Iris McFarlane, called Green Gold, the Empire of Tea, will be published in a Chinese translation. I cannot think of any better place to launch this book, so to speak, than here in the distinguished University of Peking, which is where the talk was originally given. I thank you for inviting me and for attending this talk. Nor is there a better place to launch a book on the history and influence of tea on world civilization than the capital of the greatest tea nation in history. Tea and China are almost synonymous. Indeed, for a Westerner to bring a book on tea to China seems rather audacious, as there are many already. But I hope to bring a different perspective to the study of your favourite drink, a drink which has united and divided Britain and China for good and bad for nearly 300 years. I don't know whether it has occurred to you that tea both made and almost destroyed China. It has been the secret source of much of its greatness, but in the end, through the craving it induced elsewhere and the strength it gave, it led to terrible disasters from which China is only now recovering. Let me explain. Tea, Camellia sinensis, Chinese camellia, originated in the hot, wet jungles of the eastern Himalayas, in the Burma, Assam and Yunnan triangle. By the time of the unification of China in the 3rd century before Christ, it was already known in the monastic gardens and aristocratic households of part of China as a wonderful medicine and a drink that helped in Buddhist meditation. It became a national drink and universally admired around the time of the rise of the Tang dynasty. Its spread coincided with the great move southwards of Chinese civilization in arguably China's most glorious period, the late Tang and Song empires from the 9th to the 13th centuries AD. One suggestion we make in our book is that the sudden rapid growth of population numbers and economic wealth in this time, linked to the spread of intensive rice cultivation in the Yangtze Delta, may have been made possible by tea. Tea helps in two ways. Firstly, it gives extra energy in farming. The caffeine in the tea relaxes and invigorates and gives better muscles, muscle use and brain concentration. Just as the Japanese were to find in their great medieval expansion from the time of tea introduction in the 13th century, tea makes possible the grinding work of wet rice production on minimal diets. Likewise, the British were also to discover in their great spurt, the Industrial Revolution from the later 18th century, that tea helps overcome fatigue and makes complex and difficult work possible. If we subtract tea from the Tang Song period, I suspect the effort would have been seriously diminished. Secondly, as the population of China increased rapidly, as it was also to do later in Japan and England, it soon faced one of the greatest obstacles to human progress, The huge cities and crowded countryside of the Song, the late medieval period in Japan as well, and the industrial cities of England, produced a huge amount of human created waste, excrement. This polluted the water supplies. The danger of dysentery and later cholera and typhoid increased. Infants are likely to die soon after birth, adults to be constantly sick. What can people do to avoid this almost certain disaster? In China, Japan, or England, there was no obvious alternative to drinking polluted water. Milk is equally dangerous before pasteurization, and in any case, there were not enough milking animals to supply the population with their main drink, except perhaps in England. Beers or wines use too much of the grain crop to be the staple drink to provide an average of 2 to 3 pints of liquor a day per person, certainly in Japan and China. Coffee had not spread by this time. By one of the great accidents of history, it was discovered that by infusing an easily grown leaf in boiling water, it was possible to make a very cheap drink, which could safely and very pleasurably be drunk all the time. It was the safest of all drinks for two reasons. Firstly, there is the obvious fact that the boiling of the water killed many bacteria. If the boiled water was drunk straight away, having been boiled for at least 5 minutes, and the cup was fairly sterile, it would be safe. But more surprisingly, there was another protection. In the early Chinese books on tea, and those in Japan, when it was introduced there in the 13th century again, tea is described as a medicine, like ginseng. It is said to have a bitter taste, which reveals something which is good for many diseases, among them what was called drinking water sickness. It was believed to have some kind of antiseptic content. When I read this in early books about medicine and health and life in China and Japan, it gave me the clue I needed. I followed the chain from the waterborne diseases through drink and discovered that of the many more than 500 chemicals in tea, the most abundant is what is called tea tannin, which is another term for what is technically called phenolics in chemistry. Phenolics are one of the most powerful antiseptics known to man. They were the basis of the carbolic disinfectants which Lister used in the 19th century to revolutionize the cleanliness of hospitals. When the microscope developed in the late 19th century and bacteria were discovered, it became possible to test the effects of tea. Experiments showed that typhoid, dysentery, and cholera bacilli were all destroyed when put into a solution of cold tea. It was not the boiling that killed them, but something in the tea. So when people drank tea, they did not just drink a sterilized water made sterilized by the boiling, but a substance that cleans out the mouth and the stomach. Early experiments in England, as early as the early 18th century, had shown how frogs' legs immersed in cold tea remained moderately flexible and healthy, while those put in cold water quickly developed gangrene and putrefied. So what the Chinese had discovered was an enormously powerful medicine, which they were also the first to note was effective in diminishing the likelihood of many other diseases of the brain, heart, and body. So tea, in a second way, made possible the flourishing of Tang, Song, China. Likewise, a few centuries later, it enabled the flourishing of late medieval Japan. And even later, when it was introduced in bulk into mid-18th century Britain, it made possible the British Industrial Revolution. Our world was changed by this humble drink in the rapid growth of three of the great empires in history. But it also had negative effects. While tea could be said to have made the great expansion of China possible, in two other ways it may also have brought terrible consequences for China. The first is a hypothesis which I didn't include in the book on the Empire of Tea, since the evidence is as yet thin. It is just a guess. Perhaps I can float this idea before you so that someone somewhere can test the hypothesis better. Tibet early on became one of the great tea drinking nations of the world, relying largely on exports from China. There is no way in which the Tibetans in the past or even today could have had their high level of civilization without tea. Likewise, tea was a stimulant and energy giver on the massive trade routes on the Silk Road. What interests me, however, is the possible effect tea may have had on other great pastoral nomadic groups on China's borders, especially the Mongols and Manchus. If tea, early on, became a significant export to the Mongols and later the Manchus, this may have had a tremendous consequence. Tea, among other things, is a significant source of vitamin C. In its green form, a cup of tea has more vitamin C than a cup of orange juice. In its brown form, tea contains an enzyme which greatly helps to increase the vitamin C value of green vegetables. Hence, it was early noticed to be effective against scurvy. In the vegetable scarce areas of the steppes on the borders of China, this was probably very important. Likewise, the energy which tea gives, especially in cold climates, through the caffeine, plus the protection it offers against various diseases, especially waterborne ones, are all significant. Can this growth in tea consumption be one of the factors behind the previously largely unexplained growth in the power of the Mongols in the 12th century? Certainly, I gather from an exhibition we saw last year in Beijing, tea was widely consumed in some of the newly excavated border states. Certainly, Chinese advisors discussed at an early period the possibility of punishing the Mongols by cutting off the supply of brick tea which was sent to them in exchange mainly for horses. If this guess turns out to be true, then the invasions of China by Genghis and Kublai Khan and the later establishment of the Ming Dynasty may have been connected to tea. Later, the Manchu invasions and the establishment of the Qin may be equally unimaginable without the leaves of this little bush. All this is open to further investigation. What is less in doubt is the third huge blow that tea gave to China. This came in two parts. The first was in the early 19th century. The British had become addicted to tea in from the middle of the 18th century. The wealth of the great East India Company was largely based on importing tea. Huge fortunes were made, and it is arguable that the British takeover of India and its victory over the French was dependent on tea fortunes. There was a large problem for the British, however. How was this addiction to be paid for? All attempts to transfer tea to an area which the British controlled failed until the 1840s. So for the crucial period 1780 to 1840, as Britain went through the first industrial revolution in history and set up the largest empire that the world has ever known, the British were totally dependent on Chinese tea. At first, tea had been paid for with silver. But as the quantities of imported tea rapidly increased, the amount of silver needed increased also. The fact that the Mexican silver mines were cut off from the British by the American secession in 1776, the devaluation of silver, and the Chinese feeling that they had enough silver made this currency no longer effective from the later 18th century. What else could the Chinese be induced to exchange for tea? It seemed appropriate to try another drug, a harder drug, opium, in exchange for a soft addiction to tea. So began the opium story, with which I expect many people are familiar. This was a three-wayed trade. Opium taken from India to China, Chinese tea sent to Britain, and some silver as well, which was starting to flow back in exchange for the opium. And then the silver to India to pay for the opium. And so a tragic sequel. The Chinese attempts to shut down the trade. The first opium war of 1839-42, and the huge reparations and treaty ports forced on China are well known. And then the Second Opium War and further slaughter and indignities in 1850. The destruction of the unchallengeable superiority of China was the start of the erosion of the Qing Empire. Tea and opium had together conspired to show its hollowness. Another less well-known disastrous effect was later in the century. The British were intent on obtaining the profits of tea for themselves by growing it in their own territories. So they developed tea plantations in Assam and then Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. By the 1880s, they had undercut the Chinese markets through the use of machinery and cheap transport. In 1897, in Amoy, it was reported that 25 years earlier, some 4 million kilograms of tea, 4 million kilograms of tea were exported from this area alone. 25 years later, in 1897, only 720 kilograms were exported. 4 years later, there was no tea being exported from Hankou, modern day Wuhan. The great tea trade had totally collapsed in a period of 25 years in a generation. This sudden change was another source of that Chinese weakness, which was a background to the tragedies of the later 19th century, the Taiping, the Boxer Rebellion, and the warlord period. I've spoken of two of tea's great attractions, strength and health. But it has a third feature which has had nearly as great an effect as these. This is related to the fact that tea is a very ceremonial drink. Most drinks are consumed very simply, poured into a cup or glass, and then down the throat. With tea, there is an art in the infusing of the leaves, which the host or hostess can perform. And there is a period in the brewing and pouring which is long enough for an elaboration of ceremonial. So, around the consumption of tea has grown some of the most elaborate of social ceremonials which humans perform. These are the famous Chinese and Japanese tea ceremonies and the English afternoon tea party. The effects of the elaborate preparing and giving of hospitality have been very widespread. tea consumption and Buddhism were closely linked in China and Japan, and tea and the non-conformist Christian sects like Methodism in Britain were centred round tea. Furthermore, the particular artefacts associated with tea became very important. The massively important developments in ceramics in China and Japan, pottery and porcelain, as well as the later developments in England with Wedgwood and others in the 18th century, were inspired by making beautiful teaware. Tea also influenced architecture through the simplicity of the tea house, and its influence spread out into Japanese and Chinese painting and aesthetics more generally, and of course in Korea. It would not be difficult to find other effects. The change in British mealtimes and their nature, in which the British gave up their heavy meat breakfasts for a lighter tea and bread breakfast, and pushed back their evening meal to a later hour because they could have a tea to sustain them, was the result of tea. A change in gender relations was encouraged by the fact that ladies could now preside over an important meal, tea, and go out or invite friends in for a non-alcoholic entertainment. All this is a very notable feature of the 18th century Britain. It's even been suggested that the generally quiet, law-abiding and peaceful nature of Chinese and Japanese civilization and of the British in the disruptions from the mid-18th century is somehow related to this soothing and calming drink. Certainly the teetotaler movement thought so. In conclusion, it would be difficult to imagine Chinese, Japanese, or British civilization without tea. Later, the same came to be true of India, which became a great tea-drinking nation from the 1920s. Drunk by these nations and empires, and by the British imperial territories, the Australians are the greatest tea drinkers in the world outside Tibet and East Asia, it's not difficult to see how tea has become, in terms of volume, the most consumed substance on earth, apart from air and water. But two-thirds of the people on this planet take almost all of their liquid intake flavoured by a leaf containing over 500 chemicals, most of which we do not yet understand, has changed history. One way is to think of humans as agents, as domesticating and spreading the miraculous Camellia sinensis to most parts of the globe. But we can invert this and see the tea bush as using the blind selective strategy which has stood it in such good stead, and thereby itself creating a vast empire of tea. The tea bush attracts mammals to eat or drink it by containing the instantly rewarding caffeine. Humans, like monkeys before them, have fallen for this attraction. Furthermore, the T. camellia evolved in the most competitive zone on Earth, where the micro-variations in climate amidst the wet, warm slopes of the eastern Himalayas encouraged intense competition, not only with other plants, but also with the viruses, bacteria, and the rusts that proliferated. In this competition, T. had to maintain and develop its protections. So it's in its leaves. T. contains many medicines to protect it against viruses and bacteria. These medicines have made it one of the few plants on Earth, for example, which is not attacked by the deadly mosaic viruses and by many species of bacteria. It includes chemicals, including flavonoids and enzymes, which are now revealed to be effective against strokes, heart attacks, many cancers, eye disease, tooth decay, the stone, arthritis, scurvy, and perhaps malaria. It may even be that the early evolution of the health-giving properties of the tea leaf conferred a selective advantage on the animals, including humans who drank tea. So this made tea drinkers more successful, and they carried the plant with them. Certainly at a larger level, the tea-drinking nations were healthy, and like the Chinese, Japanese and British, were very successful. To take one example, it seems likely that the British without tea might have lost the First World War, for it was the tea that sustained them in the trenches. The real problem came when the two tea-drinking nations confronted each other, the Mongols and the Chinese, or the British and the Japanese. Of necessity, one would be defeated, but only after a bitter struggle. Once one starts to think about it in a systematic way, the influence of tea on world history seems very evident. Yet for the most part, its importance in nature has remained almost totally ignored, not only by historians, but by most of those who drink it. Confucius is alleged to have said that it would hardly be a bird that discovered air, or a fish that discovered water. To this we may add, or a tea-drinking nation that discovered the importance of tea. As the son of a tea planter, I myself had never noticed, as it were, tea until very recently, quite accidentally. I started to think about it in relation to other problems, and as my wife and I helped organize the building of a Japanese-style tea house where I am giving this renewed talk, I began to realize that tea was one of the great accidents in history. I think, personally, more important than penicillin, quinine, perhaps even than rice or potatoes. I realized that we are all members or subjects of the empire of tea. We are all caught up in our craving for that green gold, as it was called, which lightens and cheers our lives. It is the largest empire on earth, yet almost invisible.